Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another comic book content creator conversation. And today I'm joined by Crisis, as you may know him from the Crushing Crisis website or the Crushing Comics podcast. So thanks for taking the time to join me, Crisis.
I'm so excited to get to chat. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, oh my God, I can only imagine, and we're going to get into all of it, but I can only imagine how much time you spend of each given day, each given week to comics. Your website is amazing. I certainly use it as a resource. Listeners, we do our Marvel reading order, every Saturday. We're currently doing the Thanos reading order. This is the man that put together the Thanos reading order that we use. So, thank you for that. It's incredible. And it's just an incredible resource. So, like I said, it's a lot to get through. I'm really excited to kind of pick your brain and find out about your journey. But we always got to start with a secret origin. So take us through your journey. Did you read comics as a very young child? Like, how did you discover comic books?
I had comics around as a kid. I grew up in the States, in the Philadelphia area. And, I would have like a comic here or there. I remember I had an issue of Captain America, Bloodstone Hunt, maybe an old Conan comic. But I wasn't a comics fan, although I was aware of all those characters from cartoons and toys and things. But I remember being in a mall bookstore and seeing the spinner rack, and it had X-Men 1991, number 3, Chris Claremont's last issue, hilariously. And I just remember looking at the cover. It's a really striking cover of the whole team fighting, and it's on a white background, and thinking, wow, this is a really interesting cast. There's a lot of women in it, because a lot of media, especially adventurous media of the time in the 80s and early 90s, it didn't really have a lot of female characters, female protagonists having agency. And so I was like, Mom, could I get this? It's a dollar. And I got it and brought it home, and kind of that was, everything was born from there. I wound up, starting to collect X-Men, reading more broadly, getting into indie publishers. And so I was a huge comic book reader in the 90s and left it behind and didn't read comics again really until 2010. And that's where all of these guys. I came back and I remember having this moment. We had just moved into a new house. I had room for a shelf that's behind me here as we're recording. And I thought, surely there's a way to get all of Uncanny X-Men. It's up to like issue 500 now. I would pay $3 or $4 an issue to get it all in a set of books. Surely somebody can just take $2,000 from me and send those to my house, right?
Right.
And discovered that actually was impossible at that time. And that's where all the comic guides came from. So I, came back with a vengeance and started with guides. And the more guides I made, the more characters I read, until I was just reading everything because I had a guide for everything.
And so how did you go about doing that? I mean, again, it's such a great resource. So you pick a character and you say, like, let's just use Thanos because that's the one we're using right now.
And one of my favorite guides. So it really makes me proud that you're following it.
Yeah. And he's one of my favorite characters. And obviously he's a household name, which wasn't, the case back when you created the guide. So like, what resources? Obviously the internet, but just that daunting task. How would you, just take us kind of through the process for tackling just one character?
Sure. Well, I think, my approach to everything is from data. And I think that even when we're fans of something, we can look at it with data and try to evaluate it that way. And I think a lot of people, when they make reading guides, they tend to just want to say, oh, what are the books in this collection? Or what are the major stories that I remember? But I like to approach it in a little bit of a deeper way than that. So I use a big combination of resources. I have all of the official Marvel indexes on a shelf just to my side. There's a lot of wonderful sites out there that index a lot of information, like comics.org, the late great comicbookdb.com, and also the Marvel Chronology Project. But then I have actually over time developed a lot of my own little secret sauce continuity databases that I can kind of plug a character into and some information, and it'll start putting it into order for me. Because a lot of times as I'm doing all my reading or my investigating, I'm like, oh, there was a guest appearance in this, or oh, he was a clone here. So when I start out, I kind of roughly try to break out the titles a character has been in. But for somebody like Thanos, or I recently just did a guide for Mr. Sinister for my Patreons, they've never had a title, really. Thanos didn't have a title until the 2000s, even though he'd been in Infinity Gauntlet and War and Crusade. And so you have to get a little bit more inventive to do it that way. So I usually kind of frame out an outline, and then I kind of use all of my background magic. And then I really honestly read all the issues, which Marvel Unlimited has made a lot easier. Let me tell you, this was way harder in 2014 when I just had to pull short box after short box to do it. But in the world of Marvel Unlimited, it's a heck of a lot faster.
So you start building the website, and then I imagine over time it gets kind of easy. Like, the more framework you've built out for a specific character, if you've done the big ones like Spider-Man and Avengers, or Batman, Superman, then it must get easier to start tacking on the other characters. Did you find that to be so, you know, the further you went along and like you said, you created these kind of tricks, is it easier now in terms of, you know, time and investment?
You know, I think there's more of a process now. It was very Wild West, again, especially before Marvel Unlimited was as developed. In 2014 and 15, I remember wanting to do Black Widow, which was one of the first characters who didn't really have a solid title of her own. And that was so hard. That and Ghost Rider, I feel like at the time just felt like they were going to kill me. And now I look back at those and I'm like, that was not hard at all. It was so obvious. Because I think that, you know, as you... Not everybody who reads comics needs to be a prohibitive expert in comics. And I think to expect everybody who wants to enjoy some good Thanos stories or some good Black Widow stories to be an expert who can navigate all the stuff on their own, that's just horrible gatekeeping that keeps some of the best readers and creators out of this industry that we love so much. So my whole MO is like, I want to fling open the gates. And if I have to like painfully look through 60 issues of a series to see if Black Widow turned up at all because the reports of her appearances are inconsistent, then that's what I'll do, because that's what my webpage is for.
Did you also find that, you know, did it catch on right away? Obviously there must be a community around what you've built here. It's such a great resource. And, you know, you even, like I said at the top, but, you know, have your own podcast, and we'll touch on that in a little bit, but is there a community established around kind of what you do? Do you have people that, you know, reach out to you and say, oh, hey, you missed this appearance over here or that kind of thing?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I really just don't have a lot of time to cultivate my own forum type of community, which is a shame, because there have been some people who've been reading me and commenting on me for all of that time. The guides first went up in 2010, but my blog has existed under the same masthead since August 26, 2000. So there's some people who've been reading it even from before it was comic books and happened to like comic books and are still reading it. But so there is a little bit of a community, but when I started in 2010, there were like not websites that did this, because I looked, if there had been one, I would have just used it. Mm-hmm. Now there's so many great websites that people have developed, you know, How to Love Comics, Comic Reading Orders, comicreleases.com, which a friend of mine has built and is a spectacular technical resource. And there's more people that have this idea of like, hey, we can take the data and turn it into consumable information. So I kind of feel like I'm the old guard a little bit, because my site is quite plain. It doesn't rely on a lot of databasey stuff. It's a lot of flat pages and it's about person power. But I'm very lucky, you know, I have a Patreon that people contribute to. I have some regular commenters who will always check me on my continuity recollection, both on my site and on YouTube and podcast as well. And that's great. But, you know, I'm really sensitive to people who ask the community to Wikify things for them and then they don't get compensated. You know, we look at what happened with comicbookdatabase.com. It was a huge resource. Everybody used it. I used it. Creators used it. Everybody freely contributed to it because they thought it was the public good. And it got sold to CBS Viacom, which was the creator's right. And I don't have anything against him. And I've actually spoken with and met his partner in the past. And I wish them nothing but the best. But it really made me realize that, A, you can't just trust wiki things to stay wikied forever. And B, none of those people got fairly compensated. And now their work is being used for profit. So anytime somebody approaches me and says, I really can fix up this whole guide, or I have a really great idea, like I will compensate that person, because that's what should happen.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it was definitely a sad day when Comic Book DB went away. I still miss it. I still check, because when it first went away, they said, oh, it'll be back at some point.
Jim Visconti said that.
Yeah. So we still check from time to time. So hopefully one day we'll see it come back. Something else I wanted to ask you about in terms of data. I saw where you kind of keep track of you posted on Twitter about what you read and whatnot. Is that a resource? Man, I would love to do that. Or is that something you built yourself to be able to tell, okay, how much Marvel did I read this month? How much DC and that sort of thing?
So for people who have not seen my obsessive tweeting about it, I keep a database of everything that I read. It's actually part of this all interconnected series of internet pipes that I have in the background of spreadsheets and databases that kind of talk to each other. So if I read, you know, this morning I read Eternals number 2 from Marvel. Now it knows that I've read that comic. It tackles it against Marvel. It kind of adds everything up. And this comes because I worked on relational databases and business intelligence for several years while I was putting together the site. So even though people might say, oh, well, it's a spreadsheet, I kind of do them with a lot of automation and macros and programming that make them kind of just like a database that it's easy to edit cells within. So I've been keeping track of everything I've read just since 2017, which is not that long ago, considering I've been reading comics on and off since 1991. But I've read, you know, 10 or 11,000, maybe now 12,000. My other window is right here, can tell me, issues since then. And I keep track of how long it takes to read everyone, what I rated everyone, you know, the publisher, the series, and all the things like that. So it just spits out all sorts of fun data, which I like. I like when people are like, I don't know, I guess I kind of like the series, and I show up with like a bar chart. I'm like, here's where I thought the highs and lows of were of the series, you know? But a lot of people use things like Goodreads for that, which is great. Not, you should never gatekeep with technology or with data or with this knowledge. It's just the thing I do for myself because I can. But I, you know, it's just as valid to read the comics and say, hey, I like that. You don't have to keep track of anything to like comics.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of touch on that. You know, you and I, we've been reading comics for so long, and you know, we do these things and we put them out there and we have content and we hope people consume it and they enjoy it. And hey man, go as far down the rabbit hole as you want to go. But by no means am I saying you have to go. Like, if you just want to pick up a comic and if to you it's like a, you know, a big action blockbuster popcorn movie, and it, you totally read it on the surface and it's just eye candy, absolutely nothing wrong with that. Go nuts.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear what you think about this. I think because so many resources do now exist for continuity guides and reading orders and all of this stuff, you get a lot of people say, well, I just want to start at the beginning of it. And a lot of times my response, especially for something like X-Men, which encompasses, you know, thousands of issues, I say, scroll through until you find a cover that looks cool to you and just read that one and then tell me what you liked about it. And then I'll tell you where to start. I don't know. What do you think about that kind of, I've got to have it all, I've got to watch it from the beginning kind of mindset these days?
Yeah. So I agree 100% with what you're saying, because here's the reality. When I started reading comics, there was no internet, you know, talking, you know, 1981, you know? And so, you know, 1980, 1981, it's like, you went to the spinner rack. That's exactly what you did. You looked for the cool cover. And, you know, back then, and I talk about this a lot on the reading orders, especially when we do the old Thanos stuff, because Marvel and DC, they both used to put this sort of in-story recap of what you needed to
do. Yeah.
They'd take a page or, you know, three or four panels and say, here's what's been going on, you know, that you need to know to get you caught up, because it was that mentality. Every comic might be your first. So yeah, the internet and the information age is great, because, you know, now I know people that, okay, they picked up Grant Morrison's Batman and, you know, started reading that. And well, who's the Riddler? Or who's this character? And they could go and Google it and find out. So it's never been easier to learn about the information, but at the same time, it is sort of that intimidation factor, that barrier to entry, because people think, I want to go back and start from the beginning. Well, we didn't have that option when I was a kid. It was, so you want to read Fantastic Four, you picked up Fantastic Four and you read it. If you wanted to read Spider-Man, you know, there wasn't really an option when I'm 5 or 6 years old to have my parents take me to go buy Fantastic Four number one, you know? So just plunge, just take the plunge and you'll find something. You'll find if it works for you or not. And don't get me wrong, I mean, maybe comics aren't for you. I know some people that love to read and they love novels, but comics aren't particularly for them. But maybe they are. And I really do believe though that, and I'll let you comment on this, Crisis. I believe there is a comic out there for everybody.
I agree. And
you will fall in love with the medium. It's just a matter of matching up the right story with the right person. Because some people don't like superheroes, so maybe you need to read Western or romance or manga or horror or slice of life. You know, so that's why I'm here. I just want to let's match up the right person with the right comic, and let's make more people read, you know, comic readers. Let's turn them into comic fans, basically.
Yeah, I so deeply share that philosophy. And I mean, there's something I want to go back to in there. Reading in the 90s, I started almost exactly a decade after you started, based on your story. You know, getting to read some really early Claremont stuff was golden, because those issues were expensive in the 90s. And I remember when they brought up the Marvel Milestones reprint of Giant Size X-Men number one. It was, I mean, it had that beautiful silver cover, just like the Milestones or the Masterworks do now. And I just remember it was like gold. Like, I couldn't believe I only had to pay $5 to read Giant Size X-Men number one, which, yes, I know was not Claremont, but it was the indisputable beginning of the Claremont run, we all know. And so I just think back to things like that, and like going to my first comic convention and my dad saying that he would buy me the core of Dark Phoenix Saga from Uncanny X-Men 134 to 137. Like, I still have those, and I'm not a floppy collector anymore, but that was really hard to do in the 90s. Now it's all, you know, it's so accessible now. And at the time, you really could never know what developed in one issue, because it was just out of your price range or unfindable. But to your other point, that's why I read so widely. Like, people are like, are you crazy? How do you read all these comics? Why do you spend all this money to read all these comics? And for me, it's because sometimes it's the most unexpected things are the best comics. Like one of the best comics of 2020 was G.I. Joe by Paul Aller. And it was not a celebration of, you know, military prowess. It totally flipped the script in a similar way to the reboot of Battlestar Galactic from TV from the 2000s of saying, what if G.I. Joe is just the resistance to, you know, the fascist heel grinding down everybody in the world, which is a totally different way to look at G.I. Joe. It was so real. It was so present. It was so beautiful. And I typically, even though I was a G.I. Joe fan as a kid, would never buy that comic book. Why would I buy a licensed G.I. Joe comic book? But I was like, it's a number one. I'll try it. And it turned out to be one of my three favorite comics of the year. But if you look through my favorites list every year, the top 10 is not usually like X-Men, Wonder Woman, like all the stuff I'm predisposed to love. My top 10 is this weird stuff. And that's why I really believe what you say is true. Like, I do think there's a comic for everyone. Even people who think they like comics, there might be a better comic for you than the ones that you're already reading. And you've just got to keep your mind open.
Yeah, that's 100% true. Because I mean, I find that the core of my base, they are big DC and Marvel guys. And yeah, we cover a lot of Marvel and DC, but you know, more and more we're talking about more independent stuff because I feel like we're entering this golden age of creativity where, you know, all the big names, you know, especially with the pandemic last year and throwing it a monkey wrench, some people were pencils down. More and more creators are either crowdfunding, so they're engaging directly with their fans, or they're going over to like Aftershock or Image or that kind of thing where they have more control. And, you know, I don't, just like you were saying with wanting to be sure that people are fairly compensated for their work in terms of, you know, contributing to a website or a database or whatever, it's kind of the same thing, you know, for these creators. Nobody wants to be the next Robert Kirkman and create a property like The Walking Dead, which generates millions, if not billions of dollars, but Marvel owns it or,
yeah,
you know, DC owns it and it's Disney or AT&T reaping the profits. We want the creators to be fairly compensated. So yeah, there's some great independent stuff out there. And I find myself reading more and more of it all the time. And it sounds like you're kind of in the same boat, right?
Yeah. And I think too, you know, when you see somebody who you really love, I mean, pick any creator that you're really loving in a big two book right now, don't you want them to be successful and build a future for themselves and know that, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, they're going to be successful? Because when we see some of the older creators who are on Twitter and social media engaging with us right now, who were the superstars of the 90s, a lot of them are in a really tough spot now. And that breaks my heart because they wrote the formative comics of my life and it was all corporately owned IP and they only get so many residuals. And now their characters are in movies and driving merchandise and they're kind of still bent over their drawing board, you know, metaphorically or actually. And so when I see somebody great right now, I'm like, let's get them onto some creator-owned. I think a lot of us have been saying for the past couple of years, where are Al Ewing's creator-owned books? Like, we love him so much. Let's get this man some IP that he can solely profit from. So I actually don't super love They Only Find Them When They're Dead, but We Only Find Them When They're Dead, but I support it because I want to see Ewing do awesome stuff on his own that are his own things to own.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point. So we just, the previous comic book content creator conversation that I did was with Mike Avila from Behind the Panel. And we were talking about kind of the distribution and how, you know, because Mike and I are of a similar age. And so, we remember riding our bikes around town, going to the convenience store, 7-Eleven or what have you, and picking them up off the rack. And
yeah,
there isn't that newsstand distribution anymore. And so it's the challenge of getting these books out there in front of people's eyes so they can check them out. But he spoke to another part of it, which is comics are so much more expensive. They have far outpaced inflation in terms of price. And there's various factors for that. But one thing he specifically mentioned is creators now are so much more fairly compensated for their work, and rightly so. And I agree with Mike. I wouldn't go back and change it. It's not that I want comics to be cheaper so more people can read them if it's at the expense of the creators not making a living wage. Right. What if you want to talk about where, you know, writing the injustice of this, we need to be able to go back in the past and comics should have been more expensive back then because of the, you know, like you said, some of these creators, you know, the reason they drew three books a month or wrote five books a month is because, man, they're just trying to make their house payment.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's easy to forget that all these auteurs in our lives, all these amazing creatives, they're just people trying to exist the way that we do too. You know, we build them up so much. And then when they make a mistake, it's really hard because we've built them up so much. But also it's really hard to see that they're worried about the same things we're worried about, you know, healthcare, the house getting, you know, a leak in it because of the rain. But now we get to form these parasocial relationships with them, and we're starting to understand the humanity. Like, I never was reading, you know, Wonder Woman in the 1990s and thinking about George Perez or William Messner Loeb's humanity. They're just these genius people, right, who were writing great Wonder Woman stories for me. And you know, I think that money conversation, it's unavoidable though. Like, we want them to make good money so they can survive and exist and make us more good comics. But many of us have an inexhaustible resource of money. And that's why I like to like come out so hard for certain indie stuff. I think you need to hear the same people that love Thanos comics and love Superman comics and Batman comics come out and swing hard and say, like, pick up These Savage Shores, you're going to love it. Pick up Murder Falcon, it is a staggering work of genius. Because if nobody that you trust who likes these other cool things as you says that, why would you spend the $4? So I just really believe that, like, those of us who are lucky enough to have some people trust our opinions, and I know I have some crazy ones sometimes, but some people still trust them or at least take them seriously. You got to swing just as hard for everything. You can't always be out there thumping your pile of X-Men comics. Like, I know it gets the hits. I mean, this is me speaking. I know where my traffic comes from, and a lot of it's from X-Men, but I really try to get in my plugs, especially for, you know, creators that are not just the same kind of old guard of creators all the time. Let's really appreciate their stuff and pay them.
Yeah, 100%. And it's so interesting to look at it that way, because Marvel and DC, they have such an advantage with the, you know, this built-in, you know, lore and legacy and shared universe. But even beyond that, the infrastructure, right? Like, you mentioned yourself, Marvel Unlimited, great resource. Now DC's got the, you know, formerly the DC streaming app, which is now very similar to the Marvel universe. And so, yeah, you can go there, you pay your monthly subscription, and there's this huge amount of, you know, material there to explore. There isn't the equivalent. It just doesn't work for creator owned, because it would be just, in a, you know, like, how do you get the rights and how do you make sure everybody's paid? It's just such a different thing. Now, Comixology, you know, their things will go on sale, you know, eventually, and they'll come down to a lower price. And of course, all this is digital, which I think the future of comics is digital. The collectible part of it, the printing copies, they're never going to go away as long as comics exist, because there are people that just want the tangible stuff. But when we're talking about the spinner rack of today, I think it's digital.
Oh, I say that all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, so being able to just browse around and try things out at 99 cents or $1.99, I think that's real important, and it sounds like you agree.
Yeah, I think about, you know, if you're building an audience for things, I don't know that all the cross-media stuff is building an audience, unless you have a rare one like Walking Dead, where it kind of hews so closely to the original material that it's really satisfying. And I'm sure the Invincible show is going to be the same way, because Kirkman's smart. But I think if we're talking about a groundswell of people who are going to be the ones keeping this industry alive financially and creatively 15 to 20 years from now, I have to think a lot of them are starting to be digital consumers, because I don't know if there's enough physical comic book shops left to support the generation that emerged like our generation. But I guess, you know, time will tell as it comes to that conversation. But yeah, I do think that, and I think with indie stuff, you know, you mentioned it's hard to just have an unlimited smorgasbord of it for rights issues, and also because the creators won't make the money. So you got to pick and choose your battles, right? Like, I always try to buy new number ones when I can. You know, a lot of times collections will be half the price of the single issues as soon as they come out, especially for smaller publishers, you know, a Vault or Action Lab, they never get any attention. They put out some fun comic books. People just treat them like it's a vanity press. They have good comics, and their first out collections digitally tend to be like $6. So if you miss getting all the individual comics at $3 or $4, it's $6. Just try it, you know, if you rather than getting one 48 page DC issue that week. And so, and then libraries too, you know, libraries have so much great stuff. They have Hoopla for lending. And I think, you know, even if you're under a budget crunch, I think there's a lot of us who are big readers out here who would love to help you A, find the comic book for you, as you say, and B, brainstorm some ways to do it without totally breaking your bank every single month.
Yeah. The material's out there, and at a reasonable price. It's just a matter of what is the right delivery system for you. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned collections, because I'm always of the opinion that you always got to read at least two, especially because if you're picking up a number one issue, man, the pressure's on. It's so hard to do the number one right, to introduce the characters, introduce the narrative, you know, squeeze it all in there. Sometimes it's only 20 pages. It could be tough. So
yeah,
always give it at least 2 issues, I feel like, to see if you're going to like something. And maybe somebody can't afford that. You know, maybe they're only, hey, I can only get, you know, one, you know, 3 books a week, and I can't afford, you know, whatever it might be. The collections are a way to solve that. Because I feel like if you just read the number one, are you really giving the series a fair shot of whether you like it or not?
Well, I also think that number ones now, and this is true both Marvel, DC, any publisher, they're their own game. Writing a number one is its own thing to master. And a lot of times, just especially with Aftershock, I find this, and I read almost every title from Aftershock, at least for a couple of issues. Aftershock has honed their ability to create number ones to a fine, fine point. It's very rare I dislike an Aftershock number one. Sometimes the number twos really let me down, and I'm like, oh, this is what the story is really about. This is how tight the storytelling is going to be. So I also think, yeah, number ones are great advertisement, but they've effectively become the movie trailer of comics.
Right.
And some people are masterful at that and great, but you actually do need the number two to even know. And that's why I actually do still like reading things in bulk and in collection, because sometimes the number one just isn't enough. I could go down the list of books last year that I rated, you know, 4.5 out of 5 or 5 out of 5 on a number one, and then the series isn't even in my top 200 for the year. And it's because number ones are their own thing, really.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And I'm glad you mentioned Aftershock. I'm a huge fan. We do Aftershock Mondays. Man, they're just, did you get a chance to read Maniac of New York?
I did. I mean, can we go to like spoil new stuff?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what your policy is.
Yeah, yeah.
Spoilers. I love the idea that New York is so tired of the serial killer, and yet he's still just actively killing people. And it's, you know, only in this moment in 2021 could that hit as hard as it's currently hitting.
Yeah.
That you're so bored with this killing, you know, it really hits. I mean, I'm sure for many people in many populations that would have hit at any point in history.
Yeah.
But it really hits for me right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, here's the subway report. Here's the weather report. Here's the traffic report. Here's the
murder report.
Here's the hairy maniac of New York report. I'm like, really? Really? Yeah. It was so incredible. Just that book for me encapsulates just the fun and crazy ideas that Aftershock comes up with. It's so, so great.
Yeah. I mean, Aftershock, if you, Ahoy, you can never go wrong trying an Ahoy number one. Vault is just constant excellence. They have such good editorial control.
Yeah.
Like, you know, get out there and try these publishers. They put out great stuff. Vault especially is just on quite a run of amazing, amazing comic books. The Autumnal is one I would call out. If you really like your kind of suspenseful, kind of small town, what's going on here, it's creepy comics. If you liked the DC Hill House stuff last year, if you like, if you tried Zdarsky's new indie book Stillwater, the yep. Autumnal is very much in keeping with all that, and it's really high quality.
So where do you find the time talking about balancing things here? You know, you've got the whole analytical side and kind of the data side of creating these regional orders and everything, but clearly you love comics and you love the creative part of it too. Like, do you schedule your time? Like, okay, I'm going to spend this part working on, you know, reading order and data, but then I've got to make sure that I have time to read my comics and then share that, right? Because we're going to talk about the podcast here in a minute. Do you schedule everything out, or you just kind of seat of your pants?
Oh, I brutally schedule everything. I mean, and additionally, you know, I am in a job role. I'm a leader on teams. I have a family. So you can't just, you know, it's sometimes everybody goes away and you're left in the house for the day and you've done all the things you can do in the house and you really truly do have 10 hours to read. But you got to budget your time. And that's part of me. I know how long it takes me to read an issue, to read a few issues. And I know how much my pull should take in any given week. So last week, you know, my full pull was predicted. Oh, hold on. I'm trying to get to the bottom here. My full pull was predicted to take me 5.5 hours, which, yeah. And so, you know, that's actually not that much time to find for it, but then you can't also be farting around and like wasting time doing. That's why I'm happy not have floppies anymore. I don't want to be spending that time bagging and boarding. I don't want to be spending that time managing a pull list. I just want to go down my list, read my comics, and then move on. So, you know, 5.5 hours for that, it's not that much. And usually I try to aim to spend no more than 3 to 4% of my life reading comics. But I don't watch television. I don't play video games. This is my main pastime. So a lot of people are like, where do you find the time? And then they talk about like binging 4 TV series and like playing a 100-hour video game, which is awesome. Love the things that you love. There's no judgment here. But like, this is my main thing. The only other thing I really do is buy Blazers and play with my kid. So I have the time to spend.
Man, we are so similar. It's the same thing for me. Like, for the longest time, I hadn't even seen the Avengers movie, and people are like, "How can you love comics and not watch these movies?" I'm like, "Cause I'm reading the comics." Yeah, and I still haven't seen. So I did with my wife start finally watching all the MCU, and we got it through. We've watched everything up through Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but I haven't seen anything past that. Just haven't had.
Oh, well, and you're doing a Thanos read. Aren't people constantly spoiling the movies for you like every 2 seconds?
See, that's the thing. I mean, even though we know that they're their own versions of things, yeah, you can't live in the world that we live in and not have things spoiled. So I've just come to accept that there are certain things. And if there is something that I really want to see, I will go see it the opening weekend. Like, I'm much more a DC guy. And so I've seen those films. I go out, and I actually did. I shouldn't say I haven't seen anything past Guardians of the Galaxy 2, because I did take my wife and daughter to see Captain Marvel on the opening weekend, Captain Marvel movie. So there are certain things that I've gone and seen. But yeah, you just, for me, it's like, I kind of, even though it's not, the end game is not exactly the Thanos story, I'm pretty sure I'm going to realize what, you know, close to what happens, you know, snap the finger, half the people disappear. So, you know, yeah, things get spoiled, but it's not a big deal for me, because again, I take it upon myself. I live in this world and I'm the one choosing to read comics instead of watching the Mandalorian. So if it gets spoiled for me, it gets spoiled for me. I'm not that worried about it.
When I also think, especially with comics as a medium that has hypertime as a concept and also is hypertextual in a way that it only references the things that it's linking to. And that's why caption boxes and things like websites that tell you what's linked are important, because you only know if somebody makes hypertext for that, right? The idea of hypertext is literally like a link on a web page, but not just a link on a web page, a caption box referring to another issue, a person who's reading guide who tells you what the background is. Any of that creates like a hypertextual environment around something. And in that environment of hypertime and hypertext, you have to have a different attitude towards spoilers. I'm like just trying to think of something totally ridiculous that could not be construed as real at all. Like, Thanos is actually Grimace from McDonald's. He it's from the Dark Grimace saga, it turns out, and it's all the same character. All the Grimace stuff is in continuity to Thanos. Like, even if I ruin that for you, you still haven't gone through the process of understanding Grimace's fall to turn into Thanos. So like, people I think get spoiler avoidant because they think the whole thing is just that one destination, but it's comics. It's not a 2-hour movie where the whole 2-hour experience was spoiled for you because you found out about some late stage twist. We're talking about like decades of storytelling, so nothing can be ruined in comics just because a spoiler happens to slip. I still am respectful of people who don't want spoilers. I'm not out there pew, pew, spoiling and stuff. But personally, I get spoiled and stuff all the time by trying to make guides about it. Right. I've had one person, you know, spoilers. In the 80s, Iron Fist is presumed dead at one point. And in the Iron Fist guide, I had to say, Iron Fist is presumed dead at this point to explain why he wasn't in any titles. Right. I didn't say how or why. And I got this really angry slash sad comment of like, how dare you ruin this experience for me? I trusted you to follow your reading guide. And I don't judge that person. It's like, that's a very different mindset, right? They might have just seen the Iron Fist TV show and were trying to experience it all from the beginning and are like, holy crap, Iron Fist dies, I had no idea. But at the same time, I didn't tell you anything about that, you know, anything about the circumstances around it. So I don't think I spoiled it, really. I just told you one destination you're going to pass in your road trip.
Yeah, I mean, when you're trying to build a database that has information that goes back so far, there's going to be inherent things that you just have to say, okay, there's a big gap here, or this is why the title, it's unavoidable at some point. And like you said, it's just because you tell them one little plot point, or maybe it's a big plot point, but it's you tell it so generally, it's kind of necessary. It doesn't, there's always what you bring to comics yourself as a reader, or what you bring to your TV show, or you know, your movie or whatever, how it affects you personally and how you receive it is so much to do with who you are as a person and what your life experiences you're bringing to it. Nobody can ever spoil that for you, ever, ever. Nobody can say, this is exactly how you're going to feel when you watch it. Nobody ever can ruin that for you. So yeah, I get the spoiler thing too, just like you said, but I also think, man, sometimes people take it too far with the whole spoiler, spoiler, spoiler. Hey man, I promise you, when I'm talking about a comic, in no way am I ever trying to spoil something for you. I'm just telling you why I think you should check it out and why I think you might enjoy it.
Exactly. Gets hard when you're talking about old X-Men comic books, but you're reading the Hickman stuff and you're trying to make a comment on the big thing that happened in House of X and Powers and X, which affects your read of every old X-Men comic book ever. We'll get into this when we talk about the podcast. And it's like, how do you tread that line about like, I don't want to ruin this new story for you, but we kind of have to talk about this elephant this undying elephant in the resurrection room.
Yeah, we're covering right now on our X Tuesdays, we're just getting into the Powers of X, House of X stuff. And yeah, it, just because of the nature of the story that Hickman's telling, like we just covered Powers of X 2. And
I know,
and
I saw.
Yeah, the scene like right at the beginning where they go to Island M and they're talking.
Yes! One of my favorite scenes in that whole series.
It's so different from what we had in the, but you can't, you have to, like you said, you have to go back and reference. You can't help it. And if people have never read, well, I was planning on eventually going back and reading X-Men right from, okay, first of all, you probably weren't if you haven't done it by now. And second of all, it's like, I can't talk about this book without referencing the history that's come before. So yeah, being that you cover a lot of X-Men in your Crushing Comics podcast, you must come across that all the time.
Well, yeah. And you dear listeners are not necessarily here to hear me spoil a lot of X-Men stuff, but there are a couple of old Claremontian characters that Hickman has a very specific take on and has somewhat changed them. Three of them in specific. I think one we could safely say without a lot of spoilers is Mr. Sinister. Cause this is the post Kieran Gillen conception of Mr. Sinister, who's a very comedic, foppish, dandy Mr. Sinister, just as evil, but much more outwardly comedic and let's say mercurial than Mr. Sinister had ever been before. Even though he was a Claremontian creation, he was a late Claremontian creation, and Claremont didn't get to put his thumbprint on him as much as with other characters that even he inherited, like Magneto. And you can't now read old Mr. Sinister without having this Gillen Hickman Mr. Sinister in your mind, because it recontextualizes everything. So I'm writing this Mr. Sinister guide, and I'm like, I have to comment on the modern Mr. Sinister from everything from his first appearance forward, because it's changed the character. And Gillen and Hickman tend to be people who actually think through that stuff. They don't just do it like, oh, hey, he's always been, you know, Hamburglar, just continue my earlier suggestion. And with one of the Hickman kind of recontextualizations of the characters, you will find that every single time she is in a Claremont issue, it completely works with what Hickman has done. It's actually like a magic trick. You almost think that Hickman has gone back and George Lucas'd all of the Claremont issues on Marvel Unlimited to make it work. But no, if you pull down your physical issue from the shelf, it just works that well, because Hickman does a certain kind of magic, you know?
Yeah, the way that man's brain works is fascinating to me. The ideas that he comes up with, they're so big, and I spend so much time thinking about it. But at the same time, you know, I just had some people reach out on social media a couple of weeks ago saying, yeah, the text pages, whatever, I just skip those. And I'm like, wait, what we even talked about in our last episode, I don't understand how somebody could skip the text pages, that they add so much to the story. But again, read it and enjoy it the way you want to enjoy it. But there's so much there, but yet it still works for people that aren't reading the text pages. So that's amazing.
I mean, it's like my policy where I won't read anything that's lettered in a cursive font. I'm probably missing things sometimes, but I'm not here to read cursive font on my digital screen. No, thank you. So everybody has their own hypertextual, hypertime version of what they're learning from their read. And mine is nothing written in cursive.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the podcast. So obviously you've had this Crushing Crisis webpage and blog, you know, for a long time, as you said, 20 years plus. And, you know, eventually you bring your love of comics to that. And yeah, you're providing all this data, and it's sort of a great resource, but it's not necessarily you sharing your passion of comics in terms of, hey, I love this story, or I love this character, or go check this out. So was that part of the reason you decided, hey, I gotta do something that's kind of a little more creative, where I'm going beyond just, you know, the data of these books?
This has a little bit of a secret origin story to it too, so I'll try to move through it quickly. I did have, before podcasts were podcasts, because there was no iPods yet, I had a podcast on that blog called Trio that was my music. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I used to record 3 songs a week, and it's crazy to me to look back now, because now there's things like Song Exploder and stuff, but there was just nothing on the internet, anything like that, for years and years. So I did 7 seasons of that, and I podcasted for a long time, and I was done, and I was like, let's put this to bed. And then, you know, podcasting got big, and everybody, your mom has a favorite podcast now. That didn't exist when I was doing that. And so as you rightfully correctly pointed out, a lot of the website now about comics, it's not a lot of personality driven stuff of me. And a lot of that started because when we moved from Philadelphia to New Zealand a few years ago, I had to pack all these darn books. And so I started a YouTube channel video series of me unpacking the books, and they were all wrapped in like paper and bubble wrap and butcher's paper to protect them. And I literally didn't know which was in what package, but it was fun to me because it was like, I was getting to go back and do unboxing videos for things that I already owned and had a relationship with. I think sometimes it feels like people are just buying stuff just to have an unboxing video, which again, I don't judge anybody, but it's fun when you can open something and immediately have a sentimental relationship with it. That's really different. Mm-hmm. And I think that that works when people are unboxing stuff that's like classic that they've already read, and then they tell you their memories and their connection to it. And so I just was like, how can I recreate that? So I did this 88 episode series of me unwrapping all of my oversized books and having that. And I discovered that there's people who did want to see the non-data side of me. So, you know, we did the Hixman Report, which the Fangirls Assemble channel hosted in 2019, where we dived real deep into every issue of House of X and Powers and X. And we were kind of in conversation with the wonderful Hoxpox Talks from Xavier Files, now Comics XF. And then I took a break. I was like, I don't think X-Men needs me to bang a drum for it right now. And I kind of stepped away from X stuff. But I really love those people. And it's different doing a podcast with other people than by yourself, as you well know. Yep. And I really just wanted to talk to them about comics again. So we started talking about X of Swords, and people were like, I have you on the dashboard of my car while I'm driving because the episodes are so long. And I was like, as somebody with a degree in music production, I probably could help solve this problem for you by making it into a podcast. So it was kind of just, we built it because people were coming. And so now it's its own thing too. You know, it's a fuller conversation on the podcast than on YouTube. It has more interpersonal stuff. On YouTube, it's very like, here's us talking about the book. But on the podcast, it's a little bit more personality driven. Yeah, and so sorry, that was long. I'm super self-conscious about how long that
was. That's exactly why we're here, Crisis. That's exactly why you're here. I love hearing the nuts and bolts stuff. And you'd be surprised how many people love this peek behind the curtain. These content creator podcast episodes always do really well. So, but I'm sorry, I haven't listened to all your episodes. Do you just do X-Men, or have you expanded to do other properties as well?
That's a question on our lips this week, because the reason we branded it Crushing Comics Podcast instead of like This Week in X, which is what we do each week, is we wanted the ability to just get together as a group and talk about whatever we want to talk about. So right now, the episodes are alternating between the This Week in X stuff and then also our classic X-Men reread, which I think we're up to like 114 or 115 this week. I don't know. We shoot them ahead. So my brain is half what's there and half what's in the can. But I think we're going to be doing some Batman upcoming. I think we're going to do Friha, who's one of my co-hosts, really loves manga. And I've really hardly ever read manga. So we might do some manga. The idea is to kind of pass around the speaker stick so that everybody gets to be an expert. I think part of the joke of This Week in X began with me being this pretty expert X-Men reader, and also Tyler, one of my co-hosts, knowing even more than me. And it was kind of funny because Freya was like, who's Jean Grey? I mean, we had to really start basic. And that was a fun dynamic, but I don't always want to cast the one woman on our show as being the one who's not the expert. Freya reads more than me. She's the expert in a ton of stuff. So I'm really eager also to have episodes where Freya gets to be the prohibitive expert and I'm the total newbie. And we experimented with that on YouTube a few weeks ago with Eternals, where I'd literally never read a comic with an Eternal somehow all this time. And so Freya and Harry like schooled the heck out of me about Eternals. So I think Crushing Comics Podcast is just anything you have a crush on. That's why my site has always been called Crushing Crisis. I mean, it used to be me having a crush on, you know, anything, you know, other people, music, IKEA furniture. It just happened that comic books really kind of came to the fore. And to me, the podcast is the same thing. Well, I fear that people are only listening to it for X-Men, but such is life. And when we roll on to Batman in a couple of months, they're either going to like it or they're not.
Yeah. Well, I find this to be, you know, once you bring them, you get them hooked because you cover something that they really want to know about. But if they like you and what you do, you know, your personality comes through either on YouTube or you know, through the speakers of the car, then they're
not the dashboard though. Stop that. Yeah, don't do that anymore.
Yeah, they're going to hang around for whatever you do. And it's so interesting, just to give you a little background. So the Comic Source, it started as a YouTube channel back in, 2012, I guess. And back then there weren't a lot of people that were doing YouTube, you know, stare at the camera live kind of.
Whatever. Oh no, it wasn't the style.
Yeah. And so I would spend, you know, 6 hours post-production adding graphic effects and whatnot for a 15-minute episode. And I was like, man, I was working at the time as a chef running a restaurant. I'm like, I don't have time to do this and I want to put out more. So yeah, well, I moved over to just doing the audio so I don't have to do that. And now it's like, man, people are like, why aren't you on YouTube just talking head at people? I'm like, really? Somebody want to stare at my head talking for? So I may go back and, you know, we're talking about it. One of the sites that I'm affiliated with, it's like, just put it on our YouTube channel. So I might get there, but for me, the most important part is just reading the books and getting the content out. So that's always where my focus is. And it sounds like you're similar.
Yeah. When I started the YouTube, you know, I like a lot of very clever, witty YouTube content. And I was trying to do so many visual jokes. Like I would talk about characters and they would pop up and sit on my shoulder. Or I'd talk about lifting up a comic box and a whole wall of comic boxes would appear. But A, the post-production takes forever. And B, like, are people tuning in for that gag or are they tuning in for the content?
Yeah.
If you have an amazing editor, like some YouTubers have a separate editor who's supernaturally gifted at that stuff and can plot so many jokes and things, then great. But those of us who are more like sole proprietor shops, I mean, the special effect of my channel is my hair. Okay. Yeah. and that's what all the effort goes into. And then it's just content from there. But I do think from this pandemic year and living our whole lives digitally, I think we've learned sometimes there's a place for just hearing somebody's voice. And sometimes there's a place for seeing them physically and interacting with them too. Like I don't think we'd be having the same conversation right now if it was an audio only conversation between the two of us, but we can see each other. And so I kind of like the idea that things come off sometimes a little bit differently on YouTube than they do audio only, in the same way they come off differently in text. You know, I hate on Jonathan Hickman a lot too. I'm one of the few people on the internet that will, sometimes it feels like. And I think it comes off really differently in audio because you can see me smiling and joking and riffing. Yeah. Whereas in a tweet, like people come for me. They're like, how dare you? I'm like, you're missing all of my tone, but that's my fault. Yeah. And so I think there exists a world for all of these things.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a lot of times people will come to me too. This is the other question I get a lot because I have so many guests, comic creators that come on the show. And they're like, how do you do that? How do you get? Well, because I put in the time, because I spent time going to conventions and networking and meeting people face to face, because it's so different. They might be getting 100 requests a week from just, you know, random guy on the internet, come be on my show. And so that's a, you know, that's a part of it too. And I wanted to ask you, because you're all the way over there in New Zealand now. I mean, do you get a chance to go to any shows? Do you come back to the States? I mean, obviously not last year with the pandemic, but I know there's like some decent sized shows in Australia and such. So do you get a chance to experience the con scene at all?
I've never really been. I mean, I know I told that story about young me and my father earlier, but I've never been a big con person. I read comics in a vacuum for so long. I think until like 2015 or 16, I wasn't even really talking to anybody else who liked comics. Mm. So for me, the past 5 years has just been the beginning of finding this community. And for me, it's a community I've found digitally. And so I don't know what I would do with myself if I went to a con. Like I met Chris Claremont, you know, with my daughter dressed as Kitty Pryde, and which was magical and one of the best memories of my life. And that's really all I needed. I don't know if I need to meet anybody else. I love some creators, but they can put out a garbage book the next week too. So I just think I come at it a little bit differently. And I hope that that's the reason that sometimes people trust my reading guides or my critical sentiment or whatever, because I don't think there's anybody that I hold up and say has 100% batting average. And there's nobody that I'm personal friends with. Now, eventually one of these people that I do critic stuff with is going to go out and be a famous comic creator. It's just a matter of time. They're brilliant. And then I guess we'll put that to the test. But it just doesn't hold any allure to me. Part of the pandemic, I mean, I know my experience is hugely different in New Zealand, but even when we were in full lockdown, which we were for a while, I was like, I'm into this, not leaving the house. I'm borderline an agoraphobe to begin with. So never touching anybody or shaking anybody's hand or ever having to wash my hands, you know, from touching things outside the house works real well for me. So I don't think I was ever a con person to begin with.
That's, in a way, I'm jealous of you because, they've become so much work. And even I cut back in 2019. I think 2018 was my peak. I think I went to 17 shows.
Oh my gosh. I don't think I go to 17 anything other than the grocery store in any given year.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but you know, I've scaled back a little bit. But now that I haven't gone in it's been a little over a year. Last show I went to was Long Beach in January, like around January 20th of 2020. So it's been a long time now. I miss seeing my friends. And to your other point, because you're right, it is tough. You know, you get to know these people personally, and I always say, nobody is out there trying to put out a bad comic. I promise you, they're not trying to do it on purpose. But yeah, sometimes things don't work. when you know somebody personally, you've got to separate that from, you know, I've got to have my, got to give, I'll call it like it is. You know, I've got to have my journalistic integrity, as it were, and say, hey, this doesn't work for this reason. Not attacking the person, which there are those critics out there that on the internet, especially, that have a hard time distinguishing such and such.
People really do.
Yeah,
they do.
No, Tom King is not a garbage person. I promise you, Tom King's a great guy. If you didn't happen to like his Batman run or Heroes in Crisis or what have you, that's a different conversation. But Tom put his heart and soul into that book, and so did Clay Mann and everybody involved. And so, yeah, you've got to learn to separate that for sure.
And it's hard because in a world where everybody else, A, is forming these parasocial relationships where they haven't even met people at a convention, they just think they know them because they liked a tweet of theirs one time. And then B, they do align kind of the product with the person so much. It's easy to get sucked into that. I mean, I look at my own tweets. I'm a very active comics Twitter person, where I talk to a lot of comics people. And I have absolutely crossed that line several times where I've equated a bad book with a bad person. And sometimes you need somebody to push back on you a little bit on that and remind you that it's not the same. But then on the other side, there's times that I've said, there's a book by this creator who I'm obsessed with and the book didn't work. And people are like, how dare you? I'm like, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
So, and I, you know, I fully acknowledge that as somebody, you know, who's geographically removed and who is, you know, who presents as a male and who is a white person, I get way less of that splashback as somebody with many other kinds of identity who might say those same things. So this is not me going like, wow, wow, wow. This is me saying like, we've got to acknowledge that we all have a little bit of maturing to do and kind of separating our critique of the work from the critique of the people. And also our critique of the critique, right? Like you cannot like a critic and they are also not a garbage person. They just have criticism that you're not in agreeing with.
Yeah. And I say it all the time, you know, it's like, if I'm come down hard on a book, I always try to one, still find something positive. I can say, maybe the colors are great. Maybe the line work is great. Maybe the,
yeah,
you know, there's, I try to find some positive, in it. And, but also say, yeah, I didn't like this. Not this is horrible. You shouldn't buy it. You know, like this didn't work for me. And a lot of times it's like, I know I'm not the target audience for this anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not made for me. I tried it. It didn't work. Doesn't mean that somebody else won't like it. But the other part is if I'm one of these critics out there who's given everything a 10 out of 10 or a 5 out of 5 stars, why should you ever listen to me? You already know if I'm covering Batman 113, you know what I'm going to say. It's great. I gave you 10 out of 10. Like, why would anybody tune in if I'm only ever saying this is the best thing ever?
When I think A, yes, 100%. I like a nice bell curve, but I read enough stuff. You know, I think people will say, well, the reason sites give so many good reviews is because they're reading the comics they want to read. If they didn't want to read it, they wouldn't still be reviewing it, which I get to an extent. But like, if you were a music critic, it doesn't work like that. If you were a TV critic, it doesn't work like that. If you were a film critic, it wouldn't work like that. All of those kinds of critics do review stuff that they don't like. But somehow we have this like weird logical fallacy in comic book criticism that because typically critics happen to be fans because nobody's making bank off of being a critic in comics,
right,
that, you know, fans read things that they're a fan of and that's why there's not lower ratings. And I'm like, well, I find that to be weird. And which is maybe why I'm so strident in saying when I don't like things too. It's not because I'm trying to be a terrible person. It's because like, can we also give some air to reasons you might not like these comics? Like, you know, our podcast, 3/4 of us are immigrants. And that absolutely colors how we're reading some of the work. And I want to be able to say, look, we don't like something, but here's us coming into it as immigrants, as people have all moved our whole families around the world and are separate from friends, you know, of half of us who are not white, who are making these comments and these criticisms. And you know, we all have different positions we're coming from and we'll still talk about an X book if we hate it. And I just wish more places did that instead of just saying, we're just going to be silent this week because we didn't like this issue. Like that doesn't help the community. It doesn't help the community when we only say good things about Tom King's Batman. And then you're somebody who didn't like it. And there's real reasons that it didn't engage you, but there's just a void of voices and like that doesn't help you as a fan know what to buy. And it doesn't help the maturity of the criticism of comics either. And Tom King is just one example of that that's easy to talk about because he's polarizing, you know, but that's true for anything.
Yeah. And the other part of it, and I mentioned speaking to Mike Avila the other day, it's this weird sort of, it's not true in TV. This is what Mike said. It's not true in TV. It's not true in film because they've got giant marketing departments.
Right.
And in comics, unless you're Marvel and DC, you probably don't have marketing at all. They're marketing, they're coming to us. you know, the people that have YouTube channels and have, you know, a following on social media and stuff and say, hey, cover this for us, because they don't have a marketing budget and we're not charging them. But it's that weird dichotomy where you've got to walk that balancing act. If DC's coming to me and say, hey, we're giving you interviews with this creator and this creator and this creator, and I'm bashing everything they do, why would they keep coming to me? But at the same time, I've got to walk that line of saying, being honest, but also being fair and not just, you know, trashing everything. So it's such a delicate balance, because like you said, I'm not making it, you know, nobody says I'm going to be rich, I'm going to become a comic creator. Now drop that down 1,000 times. Nobody's saying I'm going to become, you know, able to even earn an average income and become a comic critic. It's just money is not there.
And just the, I mean, first of all, you know, we both know stories of, I know outlets who've had their your comps or coverage or access cut because they've been only a little bit negative towards a certain publisher. So this is not speculative. And then the other thing is, you know, I know, and I could statistically tell you, X-Men content for me does like 2 or 3 times better than any other kind of Marvel content. And Marvel content in general does 5 to 10 times better than indie content. Even if I put my heart and soul and special effects and gloss into something about indie, the viewers just do not arrive. That comes after you have like a constant built-in audience. And even somebody with a modicum of small built-in audience, they still will not click the indie thing. So we have to think about that as content creators too. It's like, how do you slip in, you know, the vitamins into the medicine? One of my favorite books last year was The Kill Lock. Absolutely brilliant. Former artist on Transformers who wrote and drew it. It looks beautiful. It's about 4 terribly broken robots and them having to figure out how to survive together when all of them probably should be on a scrap heap. It's delicious. It's Machiavellian. And I can guarantee you that I could put out the glossiest video of any length with any amount of special effects and we'll get 1/5 the amount of hits as an X-Men video. So that's just the realistic part of the economics of this, you know? And so it's way more profitable to talk about Tom King as somebody doing criticism, whether you liked it or didn't like it, than to trumpet the best book of the year from an indie title. And that's a harsh reality in the market right now.
Yeah. And it's why I do what I do. And even though sometimes I think, oh, maybe it's time to hang it up, you got to just keep on plugging away, because ever since our everybody who's a comic fan, I feel like we all felt like Stan Lee was our grandfather and he was the biggest cheerleader of comics. And ever since he kind of went away, you know, passed away, it's been, man, who's going to be, there's not that figurehead that the general public can look to and say, hey, if this is the person I would listen to, if they said, this is a great comic or that's a great comic. And Stan was more, you know, associated with Marvel than anything else. But man, if we had somebody that was as well known as him, that was just like generally for comics and he could say, hey, check this out, check that out, man, what a boon that would be. But we just don't have that. And maybe someday somebody will rise up from this comic journalism sort of weird paradigm that we have right now and be able to have that kind of cred, because you and I both know if there's anything the comic industry needs, it's a constant influx of new readers. The readership has shrunk over the last few decades.
Well, and the thing that really heartens me is in the same way we have a lot of creators now who are, you know, younger than you, younger than me even, but came up on the books that we love, and you can see that influence. Like, books now take 90s influences way more seriously. Donnie Cates is like, he loves to riff on 90s stuff, and he's one of the biggest creators in the industry, and it warms my heart. In the same way, I love that there's people in other creative fields, you know, actors, TV personalities, comedians, who are huge comic book fans and who are not just picking up a comic for the first time now, although bless them if they are, but like they're coming and saying like, oh yeah, I've been reading Thanos for years. I love Thanos. That's cool. You know, when you see people, when you see Jurnee Smollett, who's in the Birds of Prey movie, who the movie's wrapped. There's no talk of a sequel, I don't think, but she's still on Twitter posting images of her reading like the Longbow Hunters. That's cool. And I think there's a lot more of that now. And so that's great. Even if we will never have Stan ever again, I do think that it's really great to see people in so many different industries being comic fans, musicians being huge comic fans, and just being nerds and saying like, yeah, I love, you know, Spawn. That's cool. You know, and especially if they're, you know, one of my favorites is Lumberjanes, you know, to have somebody out there who's like, I love Lumberjanes, and put that in the same conversation as, you know, Steven Universe and She-Ra and all these other wonderful, accepting, intersectional new works. That's great.
Yeah. And I, to that point of having these big name celebrities, you know, be involved in the industry, We know that coming up, Berserker from Boom is going to be a huge launch with Keanu Reeves. And I'm hoping that, okay, so hey, how about Matthew McConaughey? How about Jennifer Aniston? How about Sandra Bullock? Like, let's get some of these others. They would bring people, you know, they put butts in the seats, and maybe people would discover that book, like we were talking about, you know, a comic for everybody. Maybe they would, you know, could be a gateway. So,
I mean, do we have enough time on the clock for me to really go off on something here, right?
Oh,
for a
100%.
Second, related to that?
Yeah.
So a lot of people have feelings about when people do these comic book Kickstarters and their existing companies, right? So Boom did the Kickstarter for the Keanu stuff, right? That was Boom. Mm-hmm. And then also for the Power Rangers reprints too. But guess what? Kickstarter has a completely different media audience than just comics by itself. And those hits brought so much attention to comics, to Boom, to the potential of buying stuff from indie publishers. I watched the Power Rangers conversation go from, it was one of the hottest conversations in collected editions in the past year, because people are obsessed with the Boom collected editions, especially the Shattered Grid one that came out for local comic book store day. But even on top of the constant thrum of that and the collector community, it was like 10 to 100x that loud when that Kickstarter dropped, because people who love Power Rangers and would read comic books found out about it. And it's the same thing with the Keanu comic too. That has so many eyes on it now. And there's very few people in the industry who can do that organically without using something like Kickstarter to like increase the splash range. Even with Kirkman, Firepower is brilliant. It has Chris Samnee doing creator owned. That doesn't get much better than that in comic books. And even with their stealth drop of the OGN and everything, Firepower did not get the amount of eyeballs, clicks, attention as the Keanu comic book or the Power Rangers comic book. Even though Kirkman really probably has just as much pull with the general audience at this point because of Walking Dead as those other properties do. Maybe not nostalgia, but certainly in terms of, you know, it gets clicks for big sites. So I can't get angry when like Boom uses Kickstarter. There's this argument like, oh, it's taking money from smaller Kickstarter comic books. No, it's not. No. Nobody who's pledging for that thing looked and said, I could spend $100 on Power Rangers or $5 for this cool digital book that's an indie book. If anything, they're going to discover the indie book because Boom was on Kickstarter. Let's get Marvel on Kickstarter. Let's get Sandra Bullock on Kickstarter. Let's get Ava DuVernay on Kickstarter. Like, I just don't. Maybe I'm just an old capitalist pig. I don't know. But I'm like, anything that brings more people into the medium and raises the profile, I'm into it. All the ships will rise with the tide.
Yeah, 100%. And we do our, as our listeners know, we do our Kickstarter spotlights every Wednesday. And it's a question I was asking a lot of these smaller creators that wanted to come on and you know, signal boost their book. I'm like, how do you feel about it? Do you think it's hurting? They're like, oh my God, no.
No.
The more clicks that Kickstarter.com gets, the better for everybody. You know, to your point, a rising tide is going to float all ships. And there were so many people that discovered things because Scott Snyder did something, because, you know, Boom did something on there, because Top Cow was, you know, redoing Darkness and Witchblade. I do it myself. I go there and I click on, I'm looking at, you know, Athena Voltaire, and I go, okay, what else might I be interested in? As long as I'm here, let me browse around. And I think anybody who's saying that it's hurting, they haven't taken the time to do their research, or they're just throwing an opinion out there because they are making assumptions and it's not actually the case.
And so this Keanu comic, it's like, great, it got all the Kickstarter attention. Hopefully it's good. And hopefully it being good is going to have people asking, well, what else can I read like this? And you know what? Maybe for 99% of the people, it's not going to do that. But even if that 1% of people is 100 or 200 or 1,000 fans who are like, oh, wow, can I read other, oh, pardon me, I can read other comic books like this, then awesome, then terrific. And hopefully we'll all have podcasts and comic book guides and Twitter conversations and YouTube videos ready for them to welcome them into this amazing comics community.
Yeah, definitely. I agree 100%. Well, it's been great talking to you, Crisis. I feel like we should do something again in the future. And certainly listeners, if you'd like to have Crisis come back on and talk about something, certainly let me know. You mentioned being really active on Twitter. So why don't you let everybody know where they can find you in social media, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, I'll put links to Crisis's social media in the show notes, as well as the link to his site, which is also we put in the show notes every time we do a Thanos reading order. So, but where can everybody find you online?
Well, the first and most important thing is it's crisis with a K, which I don't think we've said. So if you just write the normal word crisis, like the kind that DC has, you're not going to find me. So my long running website is Crushing Crisis with a K, crushingcrisis.com. And that's where all these reading orders are that we talk about. But Comic Source fans already know that. On Twitter, I'm Crushing Comics, all spelt the normal way. And if you search for Crushing Comics on YouTube, you will find us as well, although it's under my full name right now. Gotta get the branding a little bit tighter. But generally, if you're looking for Crisis with a K, or if you're looking for Crushing Comics, you're going to find me. I don't really do Instagram, anything else like that. I'm on Twitter, I have a blog, I'm on YouTube, and that's where you're going to find me.
Okay, great. And again, everybody, I'll put links to the show notes in the show notes so you can go and find them. So again, Crisis, so great to talk to you. We'll definitely have to maybe do something in the future, and love to have you back on anytime you'd like to come back on. So it's been great chatting.
It's been a real joy. I'm so happy that I got a chance to talk to you live and in person. Thank you so much for having me.
And to all you listeners, we want to thank you for your support and for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.